Hello, my name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. And the best part? I've condensed all this historical goodness into manageable chunks, perfect for your on-the-go lifestyle. Whether you're commuting to work or squeezing in a quick break, History Shorts fits into the little time you probably think you don't have. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
And you're listening to History Teachers Talking Podcast,
part of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
All right, this is Peter Zablocki and Thomas Reska, and welcome back to our podcast. I feel like it's been a while. It's been 2 weeks, Tommy.
2 weeks. Well, I guess we were talking about this for a while, and this is what we're going to do. Peter and I are no longer history teachers necessarily by trade anymore. We still are. I'm in charge of a history department. I'm an administrator, and Peter is actually a college history professor now, and author, not just a history teacher. So we're going to be doing it, but just this is kind of like a busy time of year. So we're going to be going, to every other week now, I believe?
Yeah, every other week. Yeah, we're still, I feel like we want to still do justice to this, and we totally enjoy doing this. So, you know, as opposed to like jumping every week to try to rush it, it actually makes more sense for us to do these bi-monthly and just do it every other week and really kind of take our time with it because we thoroughly enjoy doing this podcast. Let's aim for two. Aim for two a month, but if you guys get a bonus one, you got a bonus one. That means we found some time to ignore our children and families for that week. We've been sitting on this one for a couple of weeks because this is Women's History Month. And we were kind of like bouncing ideas around like, what can we do for Women's History Month? And especially when we've done a podcast for 4 years, you know, you always come around to these big things every single year. And we're like, hey, we should do this. And we're like, we did this already. Like, yeah, I think we did.
Yeah, we want to avoid repeating stuff as most as possible. Even though history repeats itself, we want to kind of avoid repeating ourselves as much as possible here. So really what today, we're just kind of doing one of our list episodes, right? Yep. So we're really going to look at a lot of these women who were pioneers in their fields. They fought for their rights. They worked hard. They were the first in their fields, in fields like politics, sports, science, art, literature. So it's just some of these accomplishments by these trailblazing women, not just in American history, but in world history also.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to talk about the famous firsts in women's history. And the fact that we are doing this because of Women's History Month, I kind of want to start a little bit by providing some background to some of our listeners about Women's History Month, because I didn't really know much about this either, per se.
It's not as new as people think it is.
It's not, exactly. Like, I always kind of was like, yeah, Women's History Month, like, it's there. And then I started looking into how that actually happened. So Women's History Month has its roots in the celebration of International Women's Day, which was actually first observed in 1911. And then the whole idea of dedicating a specific month to honoring the contributions and achievements of women, it didn't really gain traction in the United States until 1970s. And there was part of the broader, obviously, 1970s feminist movement. In 1978, a school district in California organized a Women's History Week, and that happened during the week of March 8th to coincide with International Women's Day. A few women planned and executed this week-long series of events and activities that would focus on women's history. And the success of this Women's History Week in Sonoma County in California inspired similar initiatives across the whole country. So now schools and communities started hosting these events to celebrate women's history with like Women's History Week. And then in 1980, President Jimmy Carter issues the first presidential proclamation that declares the week of March 8th as National Women's History Week.
Jimmy Carter did a lot of that stuff. He really was a very progressive president.
Absolutely.
But we have to do Jimmy Carter.
Let's do this. I mean, we've been saying it for 4 years. It's time to do Jimmy Carter.
He needs to get his due. Maybe we can do it before while he's still alive. That'd be nice.
I know. Absolutely.
We'll get him on the podcast.
We'll see if we can get him. That's right. We have nothing to lose. So, yeah, I don't know if he's going to have time. No pun intended.
Like, that's cool,
terrible.
That's
I know. Cool. That was terrible.
That's not funny.
Nonetheless, right? So after President Jimmy Carter issues this proclamation, the National Women's History Project is funded in 1980, and it plays a significant role in popularizing the idea of Women's History Week, making it like a national event. And it grows in momentum really in 1980s. And in 1987, Congress passes a resolution that designates March as a Women's History Month. And since then, every U.S. president has issued annual proclamations that declare March as Women's History Month. So it started with a day in 1911, turned into a Women's History Week in 1970s, and in 87, it became first recognized as Women's History Month. And that's where it is today. And it basically serves as a platform to highlight different achievements of women in various fields, right? Politics, science, literature, art, activism, really. And that's kind of what we want to do today. We're going to run through some of these women's first. So
And we're going to miss some, obviously. We're not necessarily doing ones from like the fourth century and things like that. So these are not necessarily chronological order. Like
yeah,
they were just kind of throwing out some first ones out there, giving a little background. But since we are talking about women's rights and everything, we have to kind of start where a lot of it started. You can make these arguments, but we're just going to look at the first Women's Rights Convention, which meets in Seneca Falls, New York, 1848. This is obviously one that's talked about, right? It's part of the curriculum and everything like that in all the schools that I've ever been in, right?
Well, yeah, this Declaration of Sentiments. Right?
Declaration of Sentiments, modeled after the Declaration of Independence. And it basically was declaring that women were citizens with inalienable rights to the elective franchise, which basically means like women's suffrage.
Yep.
And this took place in July of 1848. And you had men there too. So there was about 240 men there and women gathered in upstate New York for this convention. And they were there to discuss like civil, social, religious conditions of rights of women. And of these women, 100 of these delegates actually decided to come together and they signed that Declaration of Sentiments, like you talked about, declaring that women were citizens. Again, this is more symbolism than anything else, but it's just one of these first organized meetings when something like this takes place. So it's saying, we are aware that we have these rights just like men, and we want our rights, we want the right to vote.
Yeah, but that was the key here, right? The key here was literally what this did in 1848 is it sparked the actual women's suffrage movement itself.
It began it. Yeah, this is the beginning of the birthplace of it.
Yep, and it took 7 decades until the women actually got the right to vote in the United States. But this is the impetus for it, is that this is where they're let it be known that, no, we deserve rights, citizenship rights. I mean, really, all they're talking about is civil rights for women. That's this. You could call this the women's civil rights movement, because they're looking for rights granted by governments, particularly the right to vote. Yeah, absolutely. That was the first one, for Women's First Rights Convention. I have one before it, which is kind of like a tidbit of history. It's not like, you know, like something as big as what you just mentioned. But Samuel Slater, you know, he's a known inventor in 1700s. But in 1793, Hannah Slater, under the name Mrs. Samuel Slater, because she couldn't go under Hannah, received the first ever U.S. patent granted to a woman.
I saw that one, yeah.
And she does this for a cotton thread. She comes up with a specific cotton thread, which actually that invention, coupled with what her husband winds up doing, helps her husband build a successful textile business, is because of her invention. But she could not, still in 1790, she could not put her own name on that patent. She had to write Mrs. Samuel Slater. But again, first woman ever to get a patent.
That's kind of where that saying always comes, right? Like behind every great man is an even better woman or something like that.
That's right. Greater woman, yep.
Greater woman. So that kind of, because she did a lot of the work, but she couldn't actually apply for the patent. And that's just something that you're going to see in history quite a bit. Like we will be talking about, or if you ever do any research, that a lot of women had these ideas or these breakthroughs, but they couldn't take credit for it because of the time period.
Again, this is 1793, but if you look at 1800s, there's a lot of firsts in the 1800s, particularly because you have, I think it's kind of coupled with the idea of what you just mentioned with the Seneca Falls Convention, right? That happens in 48. A lot of these women's firsts that happen in 1800s happen after 48. And one of the first ones that I look at is, right, absolutely, Elizabeth Blackwell, MD, first ever female doctor in the United States, right? She graduates from Geneva Medical College in New York in 1849. Elizabeth Blackwell, however, is British born, even though she became the first American, I mean, I guess in America, woman to become a doctor, but she is British born. And then another one that I saw was, that was interesting is 1872, even though women are not able to vote in the United States, Victoria Woodhull becomes the first woman to run for president in the United States. And Victoria Woodhull in 1872 wins 0 electoral votes, college electoral votes. Although even if she was to win anything, she wasn't allowed to vote.
She wouldn't be allowed to anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I thought one of the ones that was interesting is one of the first places where women could vote in the United States is one of those tricky things that always had students confused. So we know women get the right to vote in 1920. but in certain territories, in certain states, women could vote before this. And one of the first ones was the Wyoming Territory, which first granted women the right to vote in 1869. The territory legislature just declared that every woman of the age of 21 residing in the territory may at every election cast her vote. The congressman actually lobbied hard against this to happening, but they basically had to do it in order to get people there. That was another reason too. And then that right to vote actually carried into when the territory became a state in 1890. And they actually elect their first female governor, Nellie Teole Ross, in 1924. So you kind of see like the progression there, right? They allow women the right to vote. That carries over them when they become a state. And they're one of the first states to get a female governor in 1924, just 4 years after women get the right to vote at all. You kind of see the timeline there. It's a really good example.
Absolutely. And it's also kind of cool, again, from historical perspective of New Jersey, where we are recording this, is that New Jersey has an interesting case, and very noteworthy case, I would say, in history when it comes to women's suffrage, because initially when the United States was formed, women in New Jersey, by a mistake, had the right to vote. So when the yes. United States, right? So this is, the United States is formed, the first ever New Jersey state constitution in 1776 didn't specify when it wrote who the actual voting rights were granted to. So it said literally that voting rights were granted to, and I quote, all inhabitants who met certain property requirements. Yeah. So because it didn't specify gender or race, as long as a woman owned land, effectively, it allowed them to vote. So all they had to do is meet the property requirements. So a lot of people are like, whoa, wait a second. Like, we didn't mean to do this. So in 1807, the state, the first state in the United States history to give women the rights to vote, also becomes the first one to then take it away. In 1807, a state legislator passes a law that explicitly limits suffrage to only white male citizens.
Well, they had to realize that they had to fix their bylaws, basically.
Exactly. And it wasn't until the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920 that women in New Jersey gained the right to vote, even though, as you mentioned, there are states before 1920 that are already granting women the right to vote, you know, before the 19th Amendment. And New Jersey just like, no, we're going to wait till 19th Amendment. Interesting tidbit.
Absolutely. So we have some other big events in women's rights history. I thought one of them was this famous women's rights activist, Alice Paul. You're going to hear about her a lot if you ever research anything when it comes to women's rights and women's history. And she actually proposes for the first time an equal rights amendment in 1923, just 3 years after women are granted suffrage. And equal rights amendment is one of those things, and again, something we talked about, kind of doing like amendments that never passed.
Yeah.
Right? So she tried to get Congress to approve the equal rights amendment in 1972, they actually succeeded in Congress passing the amendment. It's a whole bigger, much story. That's a separate podcast. You still have, there's not enough states did not ratify it. But under the clause of the Equal Rights Amendment, basically says equality of the rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. It would guarantee, let's say, equal wages, right? All those things. There was a lot of anti-ERA campaigns that came out in the 70s, basically. Yeah.
Well, you had the conservative backlash against feminism. You had
a conservative backlash saying that women are going to leave. They're going to become masculine. They're not going to raise their children. But then they were saying that then the door would swing both ways. And then, let's say, men would get maternity leave. Women would have to be eligible for the draft, things like that, which doesn't guarantee anything that would necessarily happen. But the amendment was never passed. Actually, the ratification deadline expired in June of 1982. The last state to ratify it was Indiana in 1977. So like it took a while for it to actually even get to that point. But it's an interesting story, but it first gets
proposed
in 1923. So it took a long time even for Congress to finally hear it, 50 years for Congress even to finally hear it. So just see, this is a long battle, right? And there's constant changes and updates as we're going through.
Yeah. And I mean, basically, because of the rejection, gender equality, with the notable exception of the right to vote, is not protected by the U.S. Constitution.
But gender is a protected class.
Oh, okay. So this is still a controversial topic today, but Margaret Sanger opens the first ever birth control clinic in the United States in 1916. She was not just a nurse, she was a women's rights activist, Margaret Sanger. And once she opened this birth control clinic in Brooklyn, basically contraceptives were banned, right? Dissemination of information about them was banned. You couldn't speak about them. And so Sanger's clinic, this idea of birth control, just even talking about contraceptives and giving away contraceptives was considered illegal. Like this was considered illegal.
Because what it's basically saying is that people are having sex outside of marriage.
Exactly.
And it's just against whatever you want to say, the Lord or, you know, like the
whatever the belief or the culture or,
It probably wasn't something that was necessarily happening everywhere, but it was just kind of like the idea. I mean, this goes on, I'm going to get off on a tangent here, but even like the 1950s and 60s, when you watch those like old sitcoms, Like, I love Lucy. They slept in separate beds. Like, the Flintstones slept in separate beds because they couldn't even up that a husband and wife were in the same bed together having relations. It couldn't be advertised, basically, you know?
Yep, 100%. Well, what's up happening here? So in October, right, in 1916, you have the Vice Squad in New York City actually raids her clinic and arrests the entire staff. It seizes condoms because they say this is illegal. She tries to reopen the clinic twice, and both times the police winds up forcing her to be evicted, and she closes for good. But again, this is the first time that you have a birth control clinic.
She does create something, right? Doesn't she
do some other stuff? Yeah, 1921, right?
1921, yeah. She winds up forming the American Birth Control League. And this organization over time just kind of morphs into what we call today Planned Parenthood.
Yep.
So she's laying the seeds, the groundwork, the things that will be coming. It's not just like, oh, we open this up and everything's fixed. It takes time. Like it's just a really good example too of like this keeping your eyes on the prize or, you know, continuously pushing for what you believe is right. Because, yep. You know, it just because she got shut down and a bunch of times and in 1921, though her clinics got closed, she, you know, kept at it, creates the American Birth Control League, and it grows into this much bigger entity today in Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
The Battle of Waterloo was one of the most famous turning points in world history. But what happened next? My name's David Montgomery, and I'm the host of The Siecle, a history podcast that tackles exactly that. Join me as I cover France's overlooked century in between Napoleon and World War I. The Siecle, spelled S-I-E-C-L-E, is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and can be found wherever you get podcasts.
And I think let's, you know, we could talk about some awards, I guess. In 1903, first female Nobelist, Polish-born French physicist Marie Curie, first woman to win a Nobel Prize. She received the award for physics with her husband, Pierre Curie. In 1911, she is the sole winner of her own Nobel Prize for chemistry. So again, first female Nobelist. And then at the same time, you have Edith Wharton becomes the first woman to win the Pulitzer in 1921 for her novel, The Age of Innocence, in 1921.
That's a lot of stuff is going on in the 20s.
Yeah, but I noticed that too. Well, I think about it. 1920 is when the women get the right to vote.
I think it's being recorded. You know what I mean? Like they're allowed to actually win these things now that they have the right to vote. I think that's part of it too. Not to say there weren't great writers and stuff like this before all of this, or worthy people that could have won, worthy women that could have won these types of awards. It's just they weren't allowed to, really.
What else you got that's around this time period?
In the 20s, well, we have Amelia Earhart. We've talked about her quite a bit in the past, right? But the first woman to cross the Atlantic in an airplane in 1928, which if you're following the news, I think they found the airplane now, right? But basically, we've talked about her. We talked about her also when we talked about Eleanor Roosevelt. So she became famous, a super celebrity at the time. But I think one of the big ones just shortly after that is Frances Perkins becomes the first female member of a presidential cabinet in 1933.
FDR,
She's a sociologist and like a progressive reformer, and she serves as Secretary of Labor. And she kept the job until the end of World War II in 1945. So like she kept the job up until even past Roosevelt's death.
Yeah, she was actually a teacher. Look at that.
Yeah.
Before she became involved in social reform, she was a school teacher. First woman to serve on the New York State Industrial Commission. First to hold a U.S. cabinet post, obviously with Roosevelt. She was kind of the champion of a lot of the New Deal policies. And she helped establish the Social Security, Fair Labor Standards Act. Like this lady was
a big-time reformer.
Big-time reformer. And actually, one other one that I feel like we missed that was like 1916 when you talk about politics is the first ever congresswoman in 1916 was Janet Rankin, elected a House of Representatives from Montana, becomes the first female member of Congress. But what I want to mention about her is the fact that she served only one term because of the fact that she decided to vote against during the war in 1917. And that was the end of
Was it 1917 or was it 1941?
She did it twice.
Yeah, but I think she was the only one in 1941. But in 17, it was a couple. No,
probably true. But I know she was the one. She did it in both wars.
She was a pacifist. She didn't believe in war. Speaking of World War II, you have the All American Girls Professional Baseball League becomes the first professional baseball league for female players in 1943. I'm sure you've heard of like the League of Their Own, like that movie.
You know, I've never seen it, but I heard it's an amazing movie.
I remember watching it, and never mind like. Mom's friend brought over to watch it. It was a good movie. Without a doubt, it was a funny movie. Yeah. It was a good movie. Tom Hanks, right? There's no crying in baseball. All that good stuff. Yeah. Tom Hanks, right? Go listen to our. Speaking of him, go listen to our Forrest Gump podcast.
Forrest Gump is doing great, by the way. You guys seem to be really liking it because it's getting like.
Let's just do a whole bunch of like Tom Hanks movies, like Apollo 13, Forrest Gump.
Right.
You know, Elvis, wasn't he playing Elvis? I'm sure there's other ones.
He played a bad guy in Elvis.
Joe versus the Volcano, very historically accurate movie.
You know? I saw that movie.
I'm sure you. So you saw Joe versus the Volcano, but not League of Their Own.
I know. I kind of, the second I said that, I was like, oh, you know, you're going to bring that up. Did you see the one called Money Pit with him and the Cheers? What's the name from Cheers? Where they bought a house and it was falling apart.
Yeah, Christy Alley. No, it wasn't Christy Alley.
Not Christy Alley, the other one.
It was house falling apart. So basically you had women were playing professional baseball way before this. They did have them. They were called Bloomer Girls, right? Named after the feminist Amelia Bloomer. And they traveled the country, challenged its men's teams, and sometimes they would win. But really, you had in 1943, you had so many of the major league stars had joined the armed forces and gone off to war that the stadium owners and stuff like that ordered the game would never recover. So the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League was kind of the solution to the problem. It would keep the ballparks filled, the fans entertained until the war is over. And it wound up actually lasting for 12 seasons. And more than 600 women eventually played a lot of these. So you had a lot of these different leagues and stuff like that. And it was eventually disbanded in 1954, based as all the men were back and stuff like that. But it went for a lot longer than originally anticipated. And you had a lot of famous players that did these sorts that played during this, like Racine Wells and people like that. You had the Rockford Peaches, which probably, I think that was the most famous team. That's a team at least they focused on in the movie. They have a display of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League actually in the Baseball Hall of Fame. So they all honored there.
I did not know that. All right. So the next one that kind of pops up, and the History Channel did wrote a really good article about this guy, if you want to check it out, is actually the FDA announcing the approval of the pill in 1960, which was the first birth control drug.
Huge.
Yep. I mean, Congress literally would, like, talk about this. Like, the idea of, like, should we do this? Should we allow this to happen? FDA is, like, going through so many people coming up and questioning the validity of whether women should be given the right to have birth control. And the issue was that most of it, there was not about scientific objections to the pill itself. A lot of it was fixated on the moral and religious aspects of the pill.
Well, it's also the morality of prescribing drugs to someone who is healthy.
Yeah.
That was also something that, like, should we be doing this? Is this even something we want to do? And what you're seeing here, too, is that battle between, like, how should the government be getting involved? You see, like, science is making these strides, right? You're seeing this a lot after particularly World War II. Science is making these big strides. And then, but like the culture has to kind of catch up to it. Like, we can do this. Is it right to do this? Right. So you're seeing that. And the pill is just like another example of that. Like, is there, you know, should we be giving these drugs to healthy people? And one, should we be giving them to like young girls?
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, unwed mothers, like, or unwed women, forget about that. You know, like.
Well, there was a lot of people that thought that there was, you know, there's going to be adultery and so on and so forth. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to go a little international because we're getting into the 60s and 70s here. So in 1963, Russian cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova becomes the first ever woman in space. She orbited Earth 48 times in 71 hours. First and only woman, really, to undertake a solo mission in space, I think, to this day.
Solo mission,
yeah. Kind of cool. Next one deals with kind of breaking a glass ceiling, right? CEO of Fortune 500.
Yes, Katherine Graham.
Yep.
As we were talking about. Yeah, so she was known as Kay, and she took over leadership of the Washington Company in, I believe, 1972, and she was the first woman to CEO of a Fortune 500 company. And under her leadership, the Washington Post actually flourished, and it kind of, again, shows this connection to history. I always love when things connect like this, you know? And then she, Washington Post during his time, flourished mostly because they broke the story of the Watergate scandal to the world.
Yep. So, it was under her leadership. Yeah.
It was under her leadership. She was the one that kind of just said to, you know, to push this forward and go with the story of Watergate, the scandal that brought down Nixon. So I like to love those little like tidbits, those connections.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. In 1977, Janet Guthrie?
Guthrie, yeah.
Yeah, first woman to drive an Indy 500. She was an aerospace engineer. So she was actually trained to be an astronaut. And she winds up being cut from the space program because she didn't have her PhD, apparently. And she's like, you know what? Forget that.
That's what people don't realize. So being in the space program, you need to be in, it's not just like physical.
You got to be smart. Not that she wasn't. It's just she didn't have her PhD yet.
Yeah, you didn't have it yet. Yeah, I mean, that's totally. I don't have mine.
I know, right? And then she was like, you know what? Forget this. I'm going to turn into car racing instead. And she becomes the first woman to qualify for Daytona 500 and the Indianapolis 500. Yeah. Right now, if you go to one of the Smithsonian Museums in Washington, D.C., you could see her first ever Indy race helmet.
That's what I'm doing this summer. I'm just going to go to the Smithsonian. I have to go to D.C. this summer. Got some.
Right. I'm actually writing an article. I just got contracted to write an article for the Smithsonian Magazine. So one of my bucket list items in my life is happening, which is kind of cool.
Good. Nice little plug there. Good.
I know, but I'm proud of it. This is like a big, I told my wife, I'm like,
proud. Always gonna be proud.
I'm like, I told my wife, I was like, hey, I just got contracted by the Smithsonian Magazine. This is awesome. And she's like, great. What's for dinner? I'm like, okay. Anyway, so what do you have that's next?
So President Reagan. Okay, this one is probably a very famous one. He nominates Sandra J. O'Connor to be the first woman of the Supreme Court back in 1981. So she was conferred that September. She didn't have much judicial experience when she began her Supreme Court term, but she'd only been a judge for a few years, never actually served on federal court. But she really made a name for herself, and she became a member all the way until 2006. And you know, she was a groundbreaker, but she becomes the first female member of the Supreme Court, so the highest court in the United States. It's a big deal.
Yeah. And it's also what kind of gets me. This is 1981, and it's considered a huge deal in the United States. And yet, in 1980, you have an Icelandic politician.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah, good job pronouncing her name.
Yeah, Finn Bogadotir? Finn, it's a long name. She's a divorced single mother and becomes the first woman in world to be elected as a head of state. She serves as the president. In Iceland from 1980 until 1996. So in the United States, we're like, yeah, we have a first woman elected to Supreme Court. Meanwhile, other countries are like, we have female presidents, and we're not quite there yet in the United States. You know, we're moving in the right direction, you might say.
Well, there's people that have run, obviously. There's several women who have run. They just haven't won the whole thing.
Yep.
But I'm sure it'll happen.
All right, so what do we have next?
Let's get to athletics a little bit. I know we talked about the Women's Professional Baseball League, but John Bennett wins the first, or Bennett actually wins the first women's Olympic marathon in 1984. So it was in the 84 Summer Games in Los Angeles. She finishes women's first ever women's marathon, and she finished 400 meters ahead of silver medalist Norway's Greta Wolf. So it's like the first time they ever do it, and then she's an American, and she wins it. So it's a very big honor in those 1984 Olympic Games. It basically shows that women can do these things. Also, it was kind of debate whether or not a woman could actually like complete a marathon at this point.
In 1992, Canadian Manon Rayum, 10th goal for the Tampa Bay Lightning in a preseason game.
I remember this, yes.
The first ever woman to play in the NHL, first ever to compete in one of the four major professional sports, at all, in sport leagues in North America. I don't remember that. Right.
I don't remember because I remember seeing it on like SportsCenter or something like that. Like I was younger, obviously, but I was getting into like sports and something. You know, I don't know if you. I know you have a hard time understanding sports sometimes, but it's like
let's talk about books. You know,
these physical challenges people put themselves through. But you know, I do remember because I had a cousin who was a Tampa Bay Lightning fan. He really just liked it because the logo looked like the Flashes back then. It was like a blue Flash logo. So it was cool. But she played, and I think she did okay. She winds up
She was good internationally. I know she won 1992 and 94 World Hockey Championships for women's national team. Well, the next one that I have, too, is Aretha Franklin becomes the first woman elected to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987. And then jumping from music, I think we could also jump to Oscars. And this is a big jump because obviously Oscars just happened as we were recording this. They happened a couple of days ago. But Kathryn Bigelow becomes the first woman to win an Oscar for Best Director for The Hurt Locker in 2010. And what's interesting is she actually triumphed over her former husband, James Cameron, who at the same time was up for an Oscar for Best Director for Avatar.
So let's jump into politics a little bit here. I know we've talked about it a couple times with the Supreme Court and stuff. But then this one is a name that I remember, right, much more in my time. Madeleine Albright becomes the first female Secretary of the United States. That was in 1997. She was international relations expert, and she was sworn in as the 61st Secretary of State and the first woman to ever hold that job. Other women have held it since then, but she was the first one to ever do it. It's basically make her the highest ranking woman in the federal government history. Bill Clinton asked her to be in her cabinet, and she actually served as the country's permanent representative to the United Nations before it. So she had a lot of experience, obviously. And we know Condoleezza Rice eventually does this in 2004. I believe Hillary Clinton does it in 2009. Mm-hmm. Former First Lady Hillary Clinton becomes the third female Secretary of State. So it's definitely becoming a position that women can get, but Madam Albright will always hold the designation of being the first one.
Yeah, there's so much in the
1990s. Yeah, you see a lot more in 2000. I think we really start seeing a lot more of that progression there. Yeah. Speaking of 2000s, obviously Hillary Clinton becomes the first female president nominee of a major party in 2016. So not just the vice president, because I know you had some women be on the vice presidential ticket, I believe, in the 80s. Hillary Clinton actually becomes the nominee in 2016. for the Democratic Party, become the first woman of a major party to achieve that distinction. She did run previously unsuccessfully against Barack Obama in 2008, losing the Democratic primary. And she fought off Bernie Sanders in 2016 before clinching the nomination. And I believe when she won, they actually did like a virtual, I don't know how they did this, I guess like a screen, like the glass ceiling breaking. I remember seeing that, right? You remember seeing that, Pete? Yeah.
Vaguely.
I remember doing a big thing about it and stuff like that. Now, she didn't win the election. We know she eventually lost to Donald Trump, but she did. She was still a presidential nominee. So just getting that far is a huge step forward.
Yeah. And I feel like when you start looking at someone more current ones, when you get into 2000 and up, a lot of it, these women's first actually deal with politics. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, right, is elected Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives in 2007. She's the first woman to hold that post. A lot of people forget that. And then basically she serves until what, 2011? Then in 2019, she becomes the first person, not just woman, first person in more than 60 years to serve non-consecutive terms as the Speaker of the House. Kamala Harris, right? First female.
Well, she's the first female and first female African-American vice president, obviously. Yep. Sworn in along with President Biden. So, you know, she's literally, what do they call that, a heartbeat away from the presidency.
Yep. Well, look at Oprah Winfrey. Oprah Winfrey is actually the first woman to own and produce her own talk show. It seems like there's a lot of talk shows that are ran by women and produced by women, but she was the pioneer. She was the first one.
Just changing the way things, I mean, how talk shows are, you know, Oprah, everyone knows who Oprah is. Oh, we can't do it first without having a Margaret Thatcher, right?
I was going to say first female prime minister. Yeah.
Yeah. Of the UK. Very close friend of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
We always talk about, we should do a podcast just on her at some point.
So if you guys go out there and just type in women histories first, a lot of different things come up. I mean, Reader's Digest goes through like 79 firsts, and it goes through very international in scope. We kind of tended to stay a little bit more in U.S. focused, but internationally, you have so many different first female elected president of Argentina and so on and so forth. There's a lot of international ones out there as well. A lot of different things. So again, we don't really have the time to go through all of them, but I would definitely encourage everyone to go out there and find some of these, because there's a lot of amazing women that could and should be celebrated this month.
What I saw is a lot of them would talk about it, be like, you know, how does it feel to be the first? And a lot of them said the same sentiment, which makes a lot of sense, saying that, you know, it's important to be the first, but it's more important not to be the last. And I think that's a very important, it's a big point to make there, is that the doors were opened for future generations, you know, the next generation to achieve. And none of that would have happened if it wasn't for what was done, you know, the predecessors going back to Seneca Falls and even prior to that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, guys. We really do appreciate you tuning in once more to listen to our podcast. As mentioned before, we are going to take a little bit and do these podcasts and drop these episodes once every 2 weeks. Once in a while, we'll do a bonus episode. But by doing this, it allows us more time to kind of really focus on these episodes and really pour our heart and soul into them and take the time to research for them. So going forward, you will not have another episode for another 2 weeks. And I hope you guys tune in again to support us. So,
and also, let us know if you have anything you want us to cover. Like, we're always interested in hearing what people want to know more about.
So if you need to find us, you can find us at www.historyteacherstalkingpodcast.com. We are there to answer any of your questions. Thank you so much, guys. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Stay safe, everybody.
I hope everyone enjoyed our podcast, and if you would like to email us, you can do so at historyteacherspodcast@gmail.com.
Mad Magazine.
Advertising mascots.
B-movie posters.
And cartoons.
Oh yeah, can't forget cartoons.
If you get the funky connection that ties these pop culture gems together, you'll dig two designers walk into a bar.
See, we're a couple of creatively curious pals living between the bookends of grand museums and dive bars.
Hey, you know the place, the sweet spot where highbrow and lowbrow become drinking buddies.
So join our barroom chats as we talk influential work and uncover stories of how the familiar became iconic. Think behind the music for the stuff we love.
Check out our website at twodesignerswalkintoabar.com.
And listen wherever you get your podcasts, or visit evergreenpodcasts.com.